Hello and welcome to ICTJ Forum. Today we're discussing a new documentary film that presents the intersection of memory and music as it relates to the 1975 genocide in Cambodia. The film, titled Don't Think I've Forgotten, Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll, tracks the evolution of Cambodian music in the 60s and 70s as it morphs into rock and roll, blossoms, and then is nearly destroyed along with the rest of the country as the Khmer Rouge regime took power. Here to talk with us today is the associate producer and researcher for the film, Linda Safon. She's a Cambodian artist and scholar who herself fled the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s. She went on to graduate from the University of Paris with a PhD in social anthropology and a BA in Khmer studies. Safon's work has been included in several collective exhibitions throughout Cambodia, Myanmar, Singapore, France, and the U.S. Today, she lives and works in New York and joins us in ICTJ's offices to talk more about this new documentary. Hello, Linda, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me and to talk about the film.
Well, first, let me just congratulate you on this film. It's an incredible way of looking and at the story and telling the story. I'm curious, where did the idea to make this documentary first come from? And of all the stories to tell about this period in history, why rock and roll?
Well, I think it's really a labor of love. And it began with John Privatzi, the filmmaker. John went to Cambodia in 2001 to work on the film with Matt Dillon called City of Ghosts. And when he went there, he discovered Cambodian popular music. And, if you watch City of Ghosts, the soundtrack is quite stunning. Matt Dillon did a great choice of the variety of diversity of music he selected. And he came back here, John started to be intrigued by the history. He didn't know anything about Cambodian history, and he just go, wow, this is really intriguing. But the one thing he didn't speak Khmer or anything, and he thought, this is really good music. And then he started to embark on researching it. And every single person told him, yeah, you won't find anything, you won't find anything. And I was one of those people say, you won't find anything. I came aboard when he started to realize that he do need someone to speak Khmer, French, and English. Because Cambodia was a French colony, and a lot of documents are in French. A lot of people who survived speak better French than English. So I embarked on this project thinking, we won't find much. And throughout the course of the last 10 years, we did actually find much more than we thought. But it's mainly because John really believed of the amazing musical sound that was unique, wasn't just copy and paste from what was happening in France or in America, in England, that Cambodian musician was able to take the music and twist it to their own, crafted their own sound.
And as the film kind of shows, when the Khmer Rouge came to power, these artists and musicians were really targeted. Can you talk a little bit about that, when things started to change?
You know, the first, I would say the first popular music arrived with the with the Filipino marching bands where the king brought them, and then the royal court, the royal family listened to Tina Rossi, Edith Piaf, and then in the 50s, a lot of French yeah music and all these things. And then they started to realize maybe the better kind of rock and roll wasn't French. I shouldn't say that, the French people listening, but more like the they discovered the the Beatles, it's all discovered Chubby Checkers. So that really took a point of of westernization influence, I would say. But when the Khmer Rouge took power, they didn't see that as a opening of the mind or a new landmark, but rather as a contamination. These musicians were not doing the pure Khmer sound. They were not doing traditional music. They were just being a virus and, a parasite to society. And the way they dress also, the hippie and men had long hair, belt buttons. So it was not perceived by the Khmer Rouge and its older as a good thing for their view of the perfect traditional Cambodian person, which would be a peasant, right? So this is the opposite of what they believed in. And because they are public figure, the most popular one, the most beloved musician were had a harder time to hide the identity, so they were very much target. And there are a number that says 90% of the musicians have been victim to the Khmer Rouge, and very few have survived the regime.
And you yourself were born in Cambodia. And I was wondering if you have any specific memories of this kind of music. I think in the film it said, you know, this music is kind of considered like oldies, but no one really knows or knew the story behind it. So could you talk a little bit about your personal memories with this music?
I grew up with the music in the sense that my mother, in order to help my mother after school, I helped her to sew. My mother was a seamstress. She was a French teacher in Cambodia, but her degree was not acknowledged by the Canadian. We immigrated in Canada in 1982. And so after school, I would help her sew. And we were sitting at the sewing machine, and we would listen to this music, which I never thought that this music would become 10 years of my life. But this is like all the music I grew up, my mother, this is part of, that's the only thing that we have left. We have no photograph, we have nothing. We arrived in Canada only with like pants and shirts. And then because there are some people who retape, remastered the music, we were able to have the tapes and to listen them over and over and over again. And have a cousin who mixed up his favorite song, and I was having all these, you know, favorite female singers, the favorite male singers. And this is part of the all the diaspora, all the Khmer diaspora. It was one linking cultural legacy to our culture back home. In Cambodia, it's everybody knows. I mean, all the kids, you know, see that as their parents' music, right? But they all know the names. It's like here, you know, most kids doesn't like their parents' music, but they know who the Beatles are, who are, you know, Johnny Mitchell, she's being sick now. So this is all, but that's part of the cultural heritage, who the names. So Cambodia, this is like nothing new to them, that we are talking about this very, you know, most of the famous songs is, you go to a wedding, there's always going to be one of these songs. You go to a karaoke, they're going to be, you know, of course you're going to have the English popular song, but always the Khmer song is always there. So it is so much part of the cultural landscape.
So I will say in the documentary, the footage is simply incredible. I'm from the streets to these dark rock and roll clubs. What was the process like to actually locate this footage, and also some of the music itself?
I think that was the greatest struggle to find, right? The film has very few footage of the musician themselves performing, because first, popular music in Cambodia, like in Western country, it wasn't valued at the time that was happening. So it wasn't like we have a sense of urgency to record it. And so you think of Cambodia, most people record like the traditional music, the traditional dance, but the popular music, nobody really did anything. The television show and all these things were destroyed by the Khmer Rouge. A lot of the archival things, the record, the Khmer Rouge actually have this policy of like, you have to destroy all the records. You were not allowed to play any music from that era. Looking for it was really a challenge. But the challenge created also creativity. I mean, I have to say, John came up with a lot of, like, the Penrhyn. We have no footage of Penrhyn, so John came up with this idea of creating a shadow puppet of Penrhyn in a band to perform. So that is the one of the things. We found a few rare footage that was never seen before of Rusari Satir jumping from a parachute. We found footage of Yul Olarong at a concert, a Rai Lai concert for Lonol regime. We found footage of Sin Sisamut at a temple. But this is really like an organic way of, because we had to look for everywhere. Here in America, we look at all the different news network when they were broadcasting, you know, the Khmer Rouge. Sometimes they show some footage of journalists of the streets, of a house. We found of archival footage at the French National Archival, Institut National des Archives, and in France, in Cambodia itself. One of the rare gems is actually from the king, the former king, Norodom Sihanouk, who made many films. And throughout his feature film, he actually showcased popular musician in it. And because he did that, we were able to have really cool architectural landscape of Cambodia back then, of Phnom Penh back then. And then the last search was through a personal archive. So we went through the different community and diaspora, search for photos or anything people have. So it was one story I always like to tell is this woman in Montreal who had somehow very few people have photographed from the pre-war because you have to run away and you have to hide your identity. But she kept all her photo from the war, so have picture of her with bob hair, with like this crazy fashion. And we wanted to scan high resolution. We couldn't just take a, and she would not let the photograph album out of her house, and we couldn't bring the scanner. And I had to go and ask, like, my older sister and her older, my older sister had to ask another person of the community who just pledged for my person, saying she's a serious person. And the reality is that for her, she could lose a house and she could work her way back to buy another house. But losing this photograph is something she could not lose. And we knew that. We knew that if something happened, if FedEx lost the album on the way back, we would be not be able to sleep. But this is the few material that people have to cling to their past, since many of it, the cultural material, very few have survived. And the album covers that you will see in the art exhibit is also one of the few artifacts that have left the Khmer Rouge, have, you know, the people managed to survive. And it's not just the Khmer Rouge, it's also Phnom Penh was empty and it's neglect. And when people came back, it was basically struggle to survive. So people didn't think, oh, I have to archive this or I have to protect that. It's only way after 20, 25 years later after people started to say, maybe we start to think of keeping, preserving. Right, once we have our hunger fed and our have sheltered a house. So it, that long process of finding footage. And there's obviously last footage, recreation scenes where, you know, we go and try to create some reenactment. A lot of architecture, for example, is John shooting bollocks to give that effects of oldies. So we don't have to, you know, we don't have the footage, and then we just create the feeling of the 60s images.
And I understand this film has already been premiered in the country, and it will be premiering soon in New York at Film Forum, and we will be actually helping promote the film. And on the 27th, our president, ICTJ president David Tolbert, will be joining the film director for a discussion after the film. But tell me about the premiere in Cambodia. What was that like?
It was crazy good, I have to say. I'm very proud that the team, the whole team, had valued that the first place we wanted to premiere was in Cambodia. We wanted to give back to the people. First, for all the crew that volunteer and work so hard, for the musicians. We wanted them, all of them, what's the first time they saw it, the film with all the audience. So it's a theater that was symbolic. It's Chatumuk. It was built by Von Levan, and he was there. And so the theater only holds 720, but I think a few hundred more people, they're sitting on the stairs. It was not the most safe moment, but we realized that a lot of people were desperate to see the film. It was really moving. The older generation was crying nonstop. The younger generation was crying for different reasons. The older generation was crying because for the first time they saw their life on screen, but a positive light. It was the 50s, 60s, 70s. It was not just about the Khmer Rouge. It was about a good time. And the sense of loss that, you know, we always think of Cambodia, we think of the genocide and war, civil war. Here, for them, is giving them back small details, that nightclub that they used to go, that car that you know. These small details really make a huge difference for, again, no more photograph, no more things that bring them back to their, you know, youthful times. And for the younger generations, a lot of them were in tears because they, not a lot of them necessarily talk with their parents of what happened. Many still confused who are the Khmer Rouge, because you have to understand it was only a year and a half ago that it was taught at school, that the Khmer Rouge, the genocide, was taught at school. So many are skeptical at almost thinking. I mean, I have one kid who actually said to the parents that the parents are making this up, right? And just to say, well, no, they're not. So that really, and bridging that gap between the generation, the Q&A was just impossible, because everyone wanted to grab the mic and everybody started crying what the film meant to them. And it was really funny because the I would say the more Westerner was hoping to have more different Q&As, say, oh, what was your process? But the Khmer people just like, this is, we just need to have this healing moment. And it was every time we screen in community with diaspora, it was always a healing moment where we need to talk because, well, maybe we don't always talk about this. So, and after the premiere, there was a concert. So I wasn't sure Cambodian people, because of the history of curfew and traditional proper young lady should be at home by 6 o'clock. So here we doing a concert, you know, starting at 10 o'clock. I wasn't sure that we won't have a crowd. The crowd was there, and they stay until 1 o'clock in the morning, and they were dancing. And you have the younger dancing, the older dancing, and I was really magical for that. And I'm so grateful that we prioritize the premiere there than anywhere else. It makes sense.
What I really appreciate about the film is something you mentioned, which is that there's such a an association of Cambodia with this just brutal, deadly period in history, but this project really shines a positive light on it. And it's true, there's just something about music that can instantly transport you back to a time and place. What are the plans for the film and making sure that it reaches these audiences, these students who are just learning about the past and their families and that experience? And can you talk a little bit more about how you hope the film will kind of reach these people?
Well, I think the one thing I have to say, John, I and Andrew always was concerned is that, you know, when I embarked on being involved in this film, I wanted to be sure that it was respectful to the Cambodian people and respectful to the history. I'm not saying that we have to lie or reinvent history, but it has to depict in a way that is not commercializing or sensationalizing. And I have to say that what convinced me when I saw John Pirazzi's film Sleepwalking Through the Mekong with dengue fever, I realized that he has that sensitivity, that saying, this is he have a sense of responsibility, that he has a story to tell in a responsible way. So the film, you know, the king, actually king saw the film. We screened it to the American embassy. I mean, American weren't depicted as the best behavior, but I think the film had been managed to be neutral in every positions. We didn't glorify Sihanouk, the king. We didn't also demonize him. It is really to give the audience to decide. We tried to depict both sides. So saying that is the same way where we want to reach out. We wanted the same, of course, the musicians, all the music lover. I mean, the film say music has no border. And hopefully that would drive a lot of people. But through that, we are also hoping to raise awareness of what happened. For the Cambodians landscape, we're working hard to make, I think the Ministry of Education will approve this to be a compulsory educational tool for high school. And because it's the first film that really tried to tell the whole picture, not just who the Khmer Rouge are, or just focus on the Khmer Rouge, or just focus on the trauma. You don't have a sense of loss if you do not tell what was before. And if you just say, well, how many million people die, that is dreadful. But if you just show what kind of life and who they are, then it just give more body to numbers, just statistics. And to a lot of people just said when they watched the film, it's just really grasp a fuller sense of Cambodian society. Everybody think they're living in a, you know, shack, palm tree, and after this film say, oh, they were modern, they were, you know, cool, and they were rocking. And I said, yeah, and that's make more human to us to connect. You know, for the Western audience, we do hope that this will bring them a sensitivity to the history and a fuller sense of Cambodian culture. That is not, I mean, Angkor Wat and Apsara dancing and all the performing arts in traditional art are amazing, but also that, you know, what's happening, the youth, and today, you know, youth are doing hip-hop and rap and, you know, hard rock, heavy metal, maybe our tomorrow future, you know, legend. So that should be valued too.
Well, Linda, Safan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. And I also wanted to invite everybody to the screening of Don't Think I've Forgotten, Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll. We're premiering in New York for 1 week at Film Forum, April 22nd through the 28th. And there's a special screening with ICTJ. ICTJ President David Tolbert will be talking about the film and transitional justice and some of the things that we talked about at a screening on Monday the 27th at 7:40 p.m. And there's also a concert planned, and I'll let Linda describe the details for that event.
Yes, so if you want to have the full experience, you go watch the film, and then after, we have the April 24th, there's two shows, 7:30 and 10:30 at the City Winery. So we had fundraised on Kickstarter, enough money to bring these original musicians to perform once in a lifetime. This is to fulfill almost their dream. You know, this is a full circle. To come and perform in the place where most of the idols come from, it's huge for them. And this is your one chance in a lifetime to hear them live. So join us at the City Winery.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.